Today's Tesho will be on case 19 in the Book of Serenity. Case 19 is entitled Yunmen's Sumeru. Introduction. I always admire the novel devices of Yunmen. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue, or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? Try to discern. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. Verse. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in its intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get hold. The blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. But don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony cock crow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning, on this Saturday morning, this beautiful Saturday morning. This is the last Saturday sit of 2018, and the next time we have a Saturday sit will be 2019. So thank you for coming. This is a great way to end one year and begin another year. This is a koan that involves Master Umon, Master Cloudgate. And a monk asks him, when you're not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? And Yunmen says, Mount Sumeru. So I should probably explain that when we start practicing Zen, one of the first things the teacher will say to you is, sit on the cushion, straighten your back, watch your breath, and try not to think. So people will find that difficult. Generally speaking, it's not easy to do that at first, because we spend all day thinking, turning things over in our mind, verbalizing. And so when you sit down on the cushion and you're trying to focus on your breath, if you're a beginner, it's very difficult. I'm sure you remember, if you've been practicing for a while, those sits where you would just sit down and just be absolutely lost in thought, and every once in a while, you'd get back to your breath, but, 20 minutes could go like that, right? And you might realize at the end of a sitting period, I haven't been watching my breath at all. I've been totally lost in thought. And I can definitely remember that being my experience at first, too, is especially when I sat at home, I would sit down and I would just, I would just lose myself in thoughts right away. It's a little easier when you're sitting with other people, and it's a little easier actually if you're sitting more rather than less. So it can sometimes happen that if you're at home and you sit for 20 minutes, the whole 20 minutes might be taken up with thoughts. But if you come here, being around other people sets a different mood. And also, if you sit one sit like that, and you get up and we do walking meditation, and then you come back and you do another sit, it's likely that your mind will be, the thoughts will be a little less gripping. the worst thing to do when you sit down on the cushion is to lose yourself in like a story or rehearse a conversation or replay a movie in your head. Those are all common common things that people do when they're beginners. And a lot of the time it's quite a struggle to pull your mind away from your thinking process to your breath. And eventually, if you keep practicing, you know, you will have sits where the breath begins to move to the side of your attention, and the thoughts begin to move to the side of your attention, and the breath is more at the center of your attention. So, you know, when you're beginning to get into deep concentration, the thoughts move over to the side. They may not completely disappear, but they're not at the center of your attention, and you're watching the breath, you keep coming back to the breath, and even though this might seem trivial, this is actually a real milestone in your practice. You know, one of the things about Zen is that when people have milestones, they don't necessarily appreciate it. If you practice regularly, you're changing your baseline consciousness. But because it's your baseline consciousness, you don't have anything to compare it to. You know, so the average person is thinking all the time. And when a certain thought arises, that person may feel a powerful emotion. So, you know, you might have a presentation to do at your workplace. And you know, you might think of that presentation, and as soon as you think of the presentation, you might feel powerful emotions like dread, anxiety, maybe a sense of helplessness. Maybe you might feel challenged or energized. But you know, generally speaking, all of our mental attention is filled with thoughts, unless we're noticing something, and then we have perception or a sensation. But generally speaking, you know, we have some perceptions or sensations, and then it's just thinking. And usually those thoughts are accompanied by emotions at some point. So, you know, if you go to work and somebody interrupts you three times, you know, you might think... why did he interrupt me? And immediately, you know, feel anger. When we begin to do meditation, it changes our relationship to our mental activity, our mental processing. So, you know, once you get to a stage where you're no longer identifying so completely with your thoughts, you have a different relationship to your thoughts. You know, normally most people think of their thoughts as who they really are. Most people do. You know, that their thoughts are the thing that is most them, actually. Many people would, you know, this is why people write diaries. You know, people write diaries as a way of discovering themselves or expressing their true selves. See, and their thoughts are thought to reveal the truth about themselves. So you know, we people in the West especially think of thoughts as who we are. You know, people will even, as you think, so you are. You know, this is a motto that turns up on the internet once in a while. Another one that turns up on the internet is often attributed to the Buddha. It's you are what you think, the Buddha. There's actually now in Tricycle Magazine a section called What the Buddha Didn't Say, I think. And they actually look at bogus Buddha quotes on the internet. And one of them is, you are what you think, because the Buddha actually didn't say that at all. You aren't what you think, as a matter of fact. You know, your thoughts are these transient, they're like playing cards, right? You know, thoughts are like cards. You know, if you think about, it's all relative. It's all relative. That's an idea, right? It's all relative. You actually didn't invent that idea. Somebody handed you that playing card, and you keep it in your deck. And when it's appropriate, you pull it out. You know, if something happens and you pull it out of your deck and put it on the table, it's all relative. And everybody goes, oh, yes, you're so right. You know, thoughts are stereotypes, basically. And most thoughts are totally unoriginal. You know, so it's all relative is the way you might deal with a certain kind of circumstance. But it's not your idea, and it's not who you really are. Somebody gave you that. You know, easy come, easy go, you know, easy come, easy go, you know, that's really not your idea. It might you might take it to heart, but it somebody else invented that, you know. We could go on and on like this. Thoughts are not really ours. They're like playing cards, they're like money, right? You know, money is in circulation. It goes to this person, it goes to this person. The dollar bill that you have in your wallet isn't really your dollar. Right, it's been in hundreds of wallets, you know, and it will go out of your wallet into somebody else's wallet, right? You know, so thoughts are like that, and when we identify with our thoughts, it doesn't create any space for us to begin to free ourselves from, you might say, their spell or their grip, you know, when I was a little boy, if I was out on the playground and somebody took a ball away from me, I might go home and say, "Yeah, I was on the playground, and you know, Bobby Westbrook grabbed the ball right out of my hands." And my father would say, "Be a man," you know. I guess he meant I should punch him right in the nose or take the ball back, right? Be a man, you know. And I remember hearing him say that, and I remember being ashamed, like, yeah, why wasn't I a man in that situation? And later, you know, sometimes I could hear my father's voice in my head saying, "Be a man." Usually when I tried to follow his advice, it got me in a lot of trouble. So these ideas are not really ours, and yet we take them to heart, and we make them part of ourselves. And so, you know, that's a kind of a trap, really, you know. If you think about people who are, one of my friends in high school was gay, you know. And I think, I knew he was gay. A few people in my high school knew he was gay, but it was very much of a secret. When I was going to high school, In the 1960s and early 70s, being gay was terrible. It was terrible. And you were subject to harassment and even violence, right? So, you know, I think my friend had to go through a long period of wrestling with low self-esteem because, you know, he had internalized all these ideas about being gay, you know. There were lots of bad words that were used about gay people. And he had those in his head, too. I think he had a lot of shame. You know, later he went to college. He associated with, when he went to a different college from the one I went to. But, you know, we stayed in touch. And he began to feel better about himself because he was associating with other people. But I think it took him a long time to free himself from those words. You know, so at any rate, you know, being able to sit down on the cushion and watch the breath so that the words in your head move to the side of your attention is a very big achievement. And if you've already done it, you know, you're in a different place and you might not realize you've accomplished something very important. You know, so you when you can sit down on the cushion and watch your breath and get into a state where thoughts move to the side and they may even at times seem to disappear. You're in a kind of thoughtless state. This is not stupidity at all. You know, in the West when we say, oh, he's absolutely thoughtless, right? Or his head is absolutely empty. We mean that, generally speaking, as an insult. And, you know, we could easily apply it maybe to our president right now, who, who seems to have an empty head. But actually, Trump doesn't have an empty head. You know, Trump's head is full of, it's not full of very good ideas, but it's full of stuff, and it just blurts out of his mouth at the drop of a hat. So, you know, if you could see Trump's mental processing, and perhaps nobody would want to look at it, but if you could see it, you know, it's probably this torrent of verbalization. You know, it seems clear that he's not able to free himself from his thoughts. In fact, his tweets and things are like compulsive. He can't get free of them. But, you know, when you can sit down on the cushion and your mind begins to become more empty, you know, this is actually a highly desirable state. Because now, you know, when thoughts arise, you don't have to treat them as though they're your true self or the truth about yourself. And that's even more important with emotions. You know, when something is making you angry, if you can sit down on the cushion and enter that empty state, you can see your anger from a distance, or you can see anger from a distance. And you realize, I don't have to take this anger as who I really am. You know, and that's a really wonderful moment. People can be definitely changed by entering that wordless state. And often when people are doing work at Sesshin on their koans, you know, because they're able to enter that wordless state, they're able to get a new perspective on their own behavior and on their own assumptions about things. Now, when we're trapped in the flow of our own thoughts, when we're sort of compulsively moving forward from thought to thought, there's no space to free ourselves and like look around and see what these thoughts are doing to us. Yeah. But when you can get into that empty place, right, you know, then you look at your anger and you think, why am I so angry? Yeah, I don't have to respond to this situation with anger. You know, it does take a lot of training to get to this place, but when you get to this place, it's easy to forget how important it is, how liberating it is, not to be the slave of your mental processing. Right? People go to therapists because therapists can provide the same service in a way. You know, they stand outside your thoughts and they can look at them from a distance. And if you practice Zen and you can get into this wordless, thoughtless state, you can look at your own thoughts in a similar way. So all of this is a part of the koan, right? In other words, you know, this idea that when we sit, we should be able to get beyond thinking and beyond ideas is a very basic assumption of Zen. The monk says to Yunmen, when my brain or my mind is no longer producing a single thought, am I liberated or not, basically? Have I gotten to it? Am I liberated or not? And, you know, what we're expecting Yunmen to say is, oh yes, that's so good. You're finally getting free from your compulsive thoughts. You're able to find a blank, thoughtless place where you can look at your emotions and not embrace them as the truth of yourself, see? So we're if you know anything about Zen, or if you know this about Zen, you know, the answer we would expect from Yunmen is, well done, or something like that. But when the monk says, is there any fault or not? He means, you know, am I still stuck? Am I still trapped or not? And we expect, you know, Yunmen to say, no, this is very good. You're working your way to freedom. Well done. Instead, Yunmen says, Mount Sumeru, right? Is there any fault or not? Mount Sumeru, right? Like, it would be like saying, did I make a mistake? And I would turn and say, a mistake? It's Mount Everest, right? You know, for us, Mount Everest would be the the obvious thing. So the koan is, wait a minute, you know, I know that being in that thoughtless state is good. What does Yunmen mean when he says Mount Sumeru? What does he mean? Is there still fault, Mount Everest? Sumeru, by the way, is a special mountain in Indian culture and later in Chinese and Japanese culture. You know, when the ancient people Indian people in ancient times imagined the universe, they imagined the universe as more or less like India, you know. And in India, there are the Himalayas, and you know, there is Mount Everest in the Himalayas. Ancient Indians thought of Mount Sumeru as the whole universe is organized like a mountain, or round a mountain. So the universe is Mount Sumeru. And then there are around Mount Sumeru, there are these little islands. They're islands. And one of the islands is called Black Plum Island, and that's where our planet is, basically. This sounds totally different from our image of the universe, right? When we think about the universe, we think about planets revolving around a sun. We think around constellations. It doesn't. The idea of the universe as a mountain seems very far-fetched. You know, on the other hand, you know, I was looking at a photograph of a nebula, and it looked like a mountain. I thought, you know, I don't think these people were doing astronomy, but it looked like a mountain. It suddenly made sense to me the universe could look like a mountain, and it was a mountain made up of all these solar systems, basically, clouds of gas and solar systems and sparkling little suns, you know. So when Indian people imagined the universe, they thought the universe was centered on this mountain, Mount Sumeru, and then there were these islands, and our island is Black Plum Island, and that's where all the creatures born from eggs are from, basically. That's how they thought of it. So we're all born from eggs or wombs, which are they thought of as like eggs inside the body, see? So all creatures who have our particular biological form live on this island, this planet, or this area of the universe, you know. So Sumeru is really important. So it's even bigger than Mount Everest. So you know, when the monk says, is there any fault or not, it's even bigger than Everest. It's Sumeru. It's the universe. So you know, you might say, I you know, if you're confused, that would be good, right? All koans have a kind of contradiction built into them. And this contradiction means that you have to sort of stop thinking, trying to answer the koan intellectually, and you have to go into deep samadhi. You have to enter that thoughtless state. And then, generally speaking, you internalize the koan by repeating a key word in the story. In this case, you would just sit there and say, Sumeru, Sumeru, Sumeru. And we in Zen believe that your conscious mind will be confused by this, but that your active unconscious mind will be activated. And this is the same idea about saying something like Om. If you say Om, if you recite a mantra, you know, the mantra might just be gibberish, right? Or the jewel in the lotus, the jewel in the lotus, the jewel in the lotus, right? What does that mean? You know, that doesn't mean anything. But if you recite it and you begin to internalize it, you know, it has an unconscious impact. It affects your mind. It speaks to you on a different level, different level. You know, things affect the conscious mind one way and the unconscious mind the other, another way. And the unconscious mind processes in very different ways than the conscious mind. So, you know, our method in Zen is to internalize what's called the turning word or the key words of the koan. In this case, it's just the word sumeru. So if you sit on the cushion and you say sumeru, sumeru, sumeru for a long time, it might feel like nothing is happening. But what's really happening is that the koan is beginning to move, you could say, through the conscious mind and down into the deeper layers of your mind. And again, this is like in some traditions of Buddhist practice, people focus on images, like a mandala, right? A mandala. And focusing, meditating on a mandala, again, might seem to have no cognitive importance, but unconsciously it can open all these doors or trigger all this, the release of all this energy. The problem for us in the modern world is that we really don't trust our big mind, what we call in Zen our big mind, our unconscious mind. We really believe in thoughts, right? We just do. You know, if you think about it, you've gone through 12 years of education where, you know, basically all you do all day is recite or do math problems and recite lines from poetry. I remember having to recite a passage from Shakespeare in the fifth grade. I had to do Mark Anthony's speech after the death of Julius Caesar. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. You know, blah blah blah. I still remember it. You know, and I spent weeks memorizing that, and I had to stand up in class and do it, and then I remember later I had to memorize the presidents. I don't know if they still require you to do this in high school, but we used to have to go from Washington right on up to the current president, I would always get stuck. It would be like McKinley, and then I'd start really sweating, and My parents would quiz me, and we had flashcards. You know, I'd go to dinner, and my father would say 4 times 3, you know, and 4 times 4, you know, 5 times 8, you know, and if I couldn't get it, we'd be back to the flashcards. I'm so glad he did that because it helped me so much, you know. So ideas are really important. They're really important, especially in the modern world. And you know, I do a lot of writing. I'm an English professor. I give my students things to read, and if they don't understand them, I help them to understand. You know, so I'm not putting ideas down. You know, I'm not putting ideas down. But we live so much in a world of ideas that we don't appreciate. We don't appreciate how much there is to our awareness, how much there is to the mind. You know, even though ideas are very important, and even though think the arts and the sciences, all of this is wonderful, believe it or not, it's just a small part of who we really are. Or at least the conscious mind's experience of these things is just a small part of how we could experience things, if that makes any sense. You know, because we live so much in our ideas, we limit ourselves much more than we ever realize. You know, I was listening on the radio the other day to Terry Gross interviewing Michael Pollan. I don't know if you know who Michael Pollan is, but he's been writing for more than 20 years. He was a food columnist for the New York Times. And he's been writing on how important it is for people to eat naturally, you know. So he's very much in favor of becoming a locavore. He began to look at all this processed food and became very critical of processed food. And then the more he read and studied, the more he realized that most of what we eat is really bad for us and that we should get back to very simple eating. And then he got involved in this locavore movement where you try to encourage local farmers to sell their goods. Highland Park has all summer long has a wonderful farmers market, and some of those farmers will allow you to sign up for a contract with them, and every week you pay them a certain amount, and they deliver like a basket of or a box of groceries to you, whatever local produce they're able to come up with. And so Michael Pollan played a big role in all of this, eating naturally, eating organically, trying to avoid food additives and all those chemicals. The other day I was making somebody something and I turned the box around and it was just like there were onions. And there were two other ingredients that I could recognize, and the rest were all chemical compounds, right? And I'm not sure I want to eat that, So, Michael Pollan has done a wonderful job of getting people to change some of their habits, but lately he's been very interested in psychedelics. And he's written a new book on psychedelics. And basically, he himself has taken a range of psychedelics. And actually, he has found the experience incredibly positive. Let me just say that, if you want to practice Zen, I really urge you not to take psychedelics. If you have taken them, that's fine. And if you take them, I'm not going to stop being your teacher. But I really think, having taken them myself when I was in college, I think they can create more obstacles than advantages. But Michael Pollan has had really positive experiences with these, and he was talking to Terry Gross on the radio. And he talked about how liberating it is for him to take these mushrooms, these psilocybin mushrooms. And by the way, he didn't just take them at home. He went to take them in a very controlled environment where there were specialists who guided him through this whole process. So he wasn't just eating some mushrooms at home and watching TV or something. That would be probably a very unpleasant experience. He was working with somebody who's has a great skill in guiding people through these experiences and teaching them how to work through their inner obstacles. But when he was talking about his experience with this, it reminded me so much of Zen. And he was saying, the problem is that we have this, he didn't say small mind, but he said we have this mind that is always narrating our experience to us. It's always judging and evaluating, and it's always trying to tell a story with us at the center. So if you think about how you go through the day, all day it's like we're always trying to shape what happens to us so that it's a story about us. And naturally, we want the story to put us in a good light. For the most part, we're successful at that. And when we're not, we have a lot of emotional distress. But we're basically telling a story all day long about ourselves to ourselves and also to anybody else who will listen. And we start doing this at a very early age. My wife has a friend, Margaret, and Margaret has a little son named Henry, who is the cutest little kid. And as it turns out, Barbara and I also have a cat named Henry. So Margaret and her son Henry were visiting Barbara when I came home from the sit. I came through the door and I went, "Henry, Henry, I was looking for my beloved cat." And this little boy comes around the corner. He says, "I'm Henry." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I know that. How are you, Henry? I was looking for Henry the cat." And then he said, you know, I have two middle names, you know. And I said, well, what are they? And he couldn't remember them. He's so cute. But he started telling me all about himself, right? And there's nothing wrong with this. You know, it's a human thing to do. He was making himself the lead actor in a story about himself. And he's an adorable, wonderful child, right? We all do this. There's nothing wrong with it. But Michael Pollan said, you know, when he took psilocybin, that disappeared. That narrating self disappeared. And he said it was as though the boundary between himself and the world disappeared. And he said it could be at times very scary, right? But he said he felt connected to the world in a way that he had never experienced before. And, you know, and he talked about working with this person who was very experienced at this. And the person said to him, you know, at one point, Pollan said, you know, sometimes when people are in a hallucinatory mode, they encounter monsters. And he said, what if a monster comes? And the teacher said, you know, if a monster comes, don't run away. You know, that monster is trying to tell you something. Well, I mean, one way to think about what was happening to Michael Pollan is that, you know, the big mind was beginning to be activated by his taking this psychotropic substance. And what we in Zen call the little mind was nowhere to be found. And, you know, actually, it probably wasn't the case that it was nowhere to be found. It was probably present and absent. You know, it was coming and going. He was probably stepping back into it at various points to ground himself, but then stepping into the big mind again. But he talked about how incredibly liberating it was not to have this narrating self operating all the time. And some of you might also know there was a book that came out about 5 years ago, written by a brain scientist, and it's called Stroke of Insight. And she was a brain scientist who had a stroke. And the stroke basically left her unable to perform certain mental functions for like a year or something like that. I may be misremembering. But she lost her power to verbalize. And along with that, she lost that ability to self-reference all the time. Now, you know, hearing somebody say that, you might think, my God, that sounds like a nightmare. But actually, in the book, she said it was the most wonderful experience in the world. Because she felt everything was alive and that she was connected to everything. See, very much like what Michael Pollan is describing. And frankly, very much like what happens if you keep practicing Zen. You know, it's definitely the case that Zen practice takes a lot of time and energy. And when you sit on the cushion, you might be physically uncomfortable sometimes. In fact, you know, that's part of the method, really. You know, if you're totally comfortable on your cushion, it's very difficult to leave that thinking brain behind. You know, as you're struggling with the pain in your legs, you know, you're actually, without necessarily realizing it, slipping out of that word, self-centered word-using consciousness. And you're slipping into your thoughtless, wordless samadhi mind, which is right on the edge of your big unconscious. So your discomfort sort of like pushes you out of your familiar mental place and into this deeper place, see. So, you know, we don't use psilocybin. You know, we work with the body and the mind just by themselves, but it's the same process. You know, when I listen to this author Michael Pollan talk about his experiences with psilocybin, those parallels were so striking because, you know, we're all doing a similar thing. You know, we're all getting through this little mind that seems so important until you step out of it. And then when you step out of it, this very powerful sense of connectedness and the world is actually, you realize, much vaster than the world we ordinarily live in. And it's not vast in a theoretical sense. You know, it's experientially immediately vast, right? Again, I would say if you haven't used mushrooms, you know, please don't use them. You know, just keep practicing doing your Zen practice. And if, you know, my feeling is that they can create obstacles. You know, the studies show that people who suffer from depression, chronic depression, can take these psychedelic substances and have enormous, enormous positives from them. And as some of the studies that Pollan cites say, you know, some of these experiences last for a year or two. And then you might need to go, like, for another experience of this kind, for more treatment, right? And I definitely believe that, you know, using meditation can take you to that place more reliably and, you know, really all the time. If you just keep practicing, you'll get to a place where you're in that thoughtless, wordless state very easily, and then there's this very powerful sense of connectedness to things. And, you know, when we're doing our koan training, we're working with our monsters, you know, that scare us and keep us, and, you know, scare us and send us running back to our small mind. But, you know, in koan training, as in Michael Pollan's experience, our monsters have something important to tell us about reality that we need to hear. So, you know, this koan is basically about how we don't experience, you know, we live down in the plains, and we don't realize who we really are, which is this, you know, this great, we are the great Mount Sumeru. You know, when I was living in Seattle, I lived in Seattle periodically at various stages in my earlier life. I remember the first time I lived in Seattle, I was living in close to downtown. And I had arrived, in the early fall or late summer, and there were clouds almost every day. If you know anything about the Northwest, it actually is cloud covered like 300 days a year. My wife, who is from New Mexico, almost went crazy living there because she's used to like 340 days of sun a year. Seattle's very cloudy, and you know what happens is that the clouds settle over the city. They come off the ocean and they settle over the city, and they're held in place because Seattle's really between two sets of giant mountains. One set of giant mountains are called the Cascade Mountains, and they're inland. But there are these islands, on the Pacific side of Seattle, there are these islands with big mountains too, or it's actually a peninsula, the Olympic Peninsula. And the Olympic Mountains are on the other side. So you've got the Cascades and the Olympics, and clouds come in off the ocean, and they get trapped between those two mountain ranges. And you get up every day in Seattle and you walk around, and it seems like right over your head there's this gray roof. And I remember coming to Seattle for the first time and, you know, just walking around town and seeing Seattle with this gray roof overhead. And then one day all the clouds were gone. And I looked over, and, you know, actually right outside of Seattle is this gigantic mountain called Mount Rainier. And it's enormous. And if you see photographs, you can see Seattle is like this little city at the foot of this giant mountain. And on a clear day, it's like there's this snow-covered peak floating above the city, and the vastness of the peak is really stunning. But you don't see it most of the time because the sky, the clouds descend, and you could go for 3 months and not realize Mount Rainier was there. So I think we live very much like that. You know, there's a great mountain inside of each of us, you know, Mount Sumeru, which is not accessible to our conscious mind. But it's there, and we can begin to explore it if we just persist in our practice. So the monk in this story has been able to reach the state of thoughtless attention. In Buddhist thinking, he's reached a state of thoughtless attention, which we could say is basically like a vipassana type mindful state. So he's saying to Yunmen, the monk is saying to Yunmen, I can enter my state of mindfulness. Am I there? And Yunmen says, well, actually not. You know, there's something deeper than mindfulness. There's something deeper. It's this experience of the great mind, that the big mind. And when we begin to experience that big mind, we begin to feel our real connectedness to everything around us. So, you know, stage one is getting into your, you could say, your vipassana mind, your focused, thoughtless mind. But in our tradition, stage two is beginning to tap into the big mind, that great mountain inside each of us. I always admire the introduction. I always admire the novel devices of Cloudgate. All his life, he pulled out nails and wedges for people. In other words, people got stuck and he helped them get through their obstacles. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? You know, why does he sometimes make it less clear what we're doing, right, instead of clarifying things? Because he wants people to encounter this deeper mind. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? I'm able to reach mindfulness. Am I done? And Yunmen says, you haven't explored the Sumeru that you are. Verse. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. If you are empty, you can begin to access your big mind. The blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as a tip of a hair in there. A phony cockcrow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion.